south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. A couple of shows ago, I mentioned that when you watch the 6 o'clock or nightly news here in Latin America, there'll always be at least one report coming directly from the U.S., coming from a Latino or Latina correspondent somewhere, and usually a big city in the U.S. like Chicago or L.A., New York. They'll be covering immigrant protests or illegal immigration, whatever, since that's all the rage now, you know? In fact, they're famous for Latin man and lady on the street interviews, deportation, immigrant rights, separation of families, and all that crap. By the way, we're always hearing people whine about separation of family. Hell, who do you think separated the family in the first place? The guy or the woman took off from their Latin home and headed a couple thousand miles up to the States. So who broke up the family in the first place? I don't get it. You're aware, of course, that whole families just don't pick up and leave. It's usually the breadwinner, the guy or the woman. And they almost always leave their conjugal partner and a couple of kids back in the home country. So again, I repeat, I just don't get this whining about separating families. Oh, and I can't tell you how many adult Latin males I've met here in Latin America who left for the States, got deported, now they're back in their home country with their wives and kids. And guess what? They left behind another wife and kids up in the States. Yeah, there are a hell of a lot of bigamous Latin males running around, I'll tell you that. I can't believe how many have double lives and double families. One up there, one down here. Don't think that's a rare case either. It's not. Oh, and if you think I'm exaggerating, come on down and I'll introduce you to a few deported individuals who got caught up in that kind of thing. In fact, one of those macho guys, Jaco, told me it's easy to keep that game going, especially if your second family is 2,000 miles away from the other. He said in most cases, the secret's absolutely safe. The families don't know about each other until some disaster strikes, like ICE catching you and deporting you. Yeah, those are the righteous kind of immigrants you want sneaking into your country, right? And you know, just when you think you've seen it all, guess what I saw last night on Latin TV live from Los Angeles? There was a Latino immigration lawyer, U.S. lawyer of Latino descent, inside a sort of lower middle class apartment with a husband and wife and two kids of Latin descent. And what they were doing for the viewing public was acting out an immigration raid with the lawyer giving the illegal family advice along the way on how to avoid being picked up or at least how to delay it. So it started with ICE showing up at the door, knocking, with the lawyer advising the viewers each step along the way in Spanish, of course, using bullet points that would appear on the screen. I'm not kidding you. They had two actors at the front door in ICE uniforms with the family standing inside the foyer and the lawyer giving advice along the way. For example, when the knock came on the door, the lawyer advised them not to answer it and to stay still and quiet. But the actors in the ICE uniforms didn't go away. They walked around the place, took a look in the windows, and came back to the front door again and shoved a paper under it. Whether that was supposed to be a summons or whatever, I don't know, because they didn't show it. But as soon as the Latino head of the house bent down to pick it up, the lawyer stopped him and said, "Don't even touch it." He said, if you even touch it, at any time in the future, if you're under oath, and they ask you if you touched it, and you say yes, that means you officially received a summons or a deportation notice. Yada, yada, yada. So those are the kind of reports they've been putting out on the Latin news channels lately. Now, this is the third time I've seen Latin lawyers up in the States pulling that stunt. And since I watch very little TV, you have to imagine the Latin airwaves are just full of those kind of reports. Which brings me to an email I just received. It comes from longtime listener Jay. He says, "Hey Johnny, just thought I'd send you this link about U.S. immigration officials actually making a trek to Mexico and Guatemala lecturing the locals to stay put in their own countries. Do you know anything about this? I imagine it's big news down there south of the border. Are they calm or are they having mass riots yet? Please let us know. Signed, Jay." Well, yes, Jay, I've known about this for a while. Seems like for the past 6 months or so now, every time a plane load of illegal Latin immigrants is sent back to their home country, They get a pamphlet, a Happy Meal, and a lecture from some deadpan, overpaid U.S. official, advising them sternly that it's not in their best interest to sneak back into the States as an illegal. And you might ask, how effective is that? Well, you know the answer to that. The fact is, nearly every Latin person's got a brother or a cousin or an Uncle Julio who's done many round trips to the U.S. and had the deportation costs paid by, who else? The U.S. taxpayers, of course. So anyway, Jay sent me a link to a Reuters article on that very subject. The title is U.S. Homeland Secretary Kelly Warns Guatemalans to Stay Home. Then it says U.S. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly on Wednesday told Guatemalans not to waste their money trying to get to the United States illegally again, detailing how his department was cracking down on undocumented immigrants and would speed up deportations. He said this, speaking after he greeted a plane full of Guatemalans who'd just been deported back from the United States. He continued, if you're a Guatemalan who's considering paying a great deal of money to a coyote smuggler to bring you back to the States, you're wasting your money. He made that speech last Wednesday at a Guatemalan Air Force base where 347 deportees arrived on an earlier flight back to Guatemala where they started from. I got a feeling he makes those speeches entirely in English. It would be par for the course if he didn't speak a lick of Spanish, huh? Okay, let me paraphrase the rest of it. It says, Secretary Kelly left Guatemala shortly after that. He was headed to Mexico, where he and U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson were expected to speak to another newly arrived group, this time to deported Mexicans. And then they were off to meetings with Mexican officials to explain Trump's new immigration and deportation policies, and also to meet and discuss issues with their Mexican immigration counterparts. By the way, it says, U.S. plans are angering Mexican officials, with their lead negotiator and foreign minister, Luis Derdergay, saying there was no way Mexico could accept Trump's deportation policies. Well, thanks for that, Jay. But meanwhile, here's something you didn't know. How would you, unless you read some of the local Latin rags and were all in Spanish? Here's an article in a very big Latin newspaper that says, Latin American countries are actively organizing educational campaigns and lectures presented at various public schools in order to alert migrants who are about to start out on that journey and pass through Mexico onto the States of the problems and dangers involved, providing them with some effective training and countermeasures if and when they encounter thieves, criminals, and gang members along the way. Then it says, these government-funded open public meetings come as a result of the fact that there are between 5 and 700 assaults and attacks a day on the migrant trail to the U.S. Anyway, if you're watching this on YouTube right now, there's a scan of a newspaper photo with a Latin cop giving instructions to a whole room full of people, each and every one of them intent on sneaking through Mexico and on into the States. Now get this, in the photo there's maybe 50 people in the class. 45 women and 5 men. So who would have thunk, huh? Latin American countries are now holding formal classes given by cops in an effort to inform and train up people who they know are going to sneak into the States through Mexico. So they're there to get some tips on how to handle the crooks, robbers, rapists, and thieves, and gang members some of them are bound to run into on their trek through Mexico. Then it says the classes and lectures are normally given by members of the police anti-fraud units. Then it says, anti-fraud unit cops are well versed in the tricks and the games coyotes often play on their own clients. It says, in many of the smaller communities in Central America where many immigrants come from, you'll see the flyers on power poles and government buildings advertising free classes for the prevention of coyote estafas, which basically boils down to, if you're going to sneak into the U.S., know your coyote. Now, one of the cops who gives these little talks says, fortunately, these sessions are well attended, often 30 to 50 people at a time. However, he said, que lastima, which means unfortunately, or it's a shame we have few young men at these sessions. The men that do attend are almost always over 50. He says it's a cultural thing. I say it's a macho thing. Same thing, I guess, where young men think they can do everything by themselves and they don't want any help. He said young men don't want to be perceived as weak or unmanly in a room full of older women. And it's true, if you're looking at that photo on YouTube, you'll see most of the women are pretty much middle-aged. Then the agent said, yes, everyone's looking for a better life. And they know there are risks. They hear the stories. The worst of which to them is rape, which is a real possibility, especially with young adults and teenage girls. That's why he says they have a special segment in their program on how women should act and dress. That is, never suggestively, never with bright clothing, and never using lipstick or makeup. So there you have it. Illegal migration has actually become institutionalized within Latin governments. In fact, they don't seem to discourage it at all. Rather, try to prepare you for the journey. Like El Comisario Rodrigo Salguero said in this article, that's the cop giving the class, he said, according to the Banco de Guatemala, in the last 6 months, the country has received $6 billion with a B dollars in remises. And according to the Honduran Central Bank, their country received $3 billion in remises during that same period. El Salvador received $2 billion in the last 6 months. And Nicaragua, the same, $2 billion. By the way, he said that's a 15% year-over-year increase in remises. Meanwhile, up in the States, everyone, all U.S. citizens anyway, and the media are talking about jobs drying up, high unemployment, little opportunity for the average Joe, and even college graduates, which doesn't quite jive with the fact that remises are up 15% year over year. You figure it out. Either there are more immigrants, illegal or otherwise, getting jobs in the States, or they're getting pay raises and you're not. Is that even possible? Oh, and by the way, here's something that just might blow your mind a little anyway. Unless your brain's been pelted by so much bad news coming from the first world, nothing has much of an effect on you anymore. In that case, when you hear this, you're just going to think someone's making it up. Oh well. This article comes from Mexico City's biggest newspaper. And it gives you reason 2,476, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Why, if you're thinking about setting up your plan B in Mexico, that might not be such a good idea. I'll translate here. It says, a new type of tour offers sightseeing of the most corrupt spots in Mexico City. You got that? And I'll paraphrase and translate here. It says, as of February 5th, 2017, Mexico City will have a brand new tourist attraction. It's called the Corrupt Tour. That's C-O-R-R-U-P-T-O-U-R. Corrupt Tour. It will bring passengers on an old school bus to 10 different famous places in Mexico's capital that are associated with very high-profile corruption scandals. Now, admittedly, it says, it is a radically different tour than those usually provided by regular tourist agencies. But the object is that all 10 of the sightseeing spots have one thing in common: endemic and pervasive corruption on a massive scale. Then it goes on to say, the tour was first launched in 2016 in Monterrey, Mexico, the capital city of Nuevo León. And due to the success of those tours, Mexico City was the next choice. So for the maiden voyage, a list of special guests and media representatives were invited to the tour's premiere on January 29th. As planned, the guests were brought to the 10 enigmatic corruption sites on the tour. Number one, Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto's, quote, White House. Number two, the so-called Pillar of Light, Estela de Luz. Number three, the Mexican Social Security Institute. The acronym is IMSS. Number four, the monument that stands near the 43 students who were recently disappeared. You read about that. Number five, the Mexican Interior Ministry. Number six, the Metro Valderas Metro Station. Number seven, the Attorney General's Office. Number eight, the Chapultepec Television Building. Number nine, the Mexican Senate. And number 10, one of the other many serious corruption sites to be selected on a rotating basis. Then it says, on top of the actual sightseeing, the Corruptor Tour provides historical information on the chosen buildings and a brief overview of the corrupt acts to which they are linked. Everything is narrated by the voice of two fictional characters, Señor Positivo and Señor Negativa. That's Mr. Positive and Mr. Negative. Both voices represent the Mexican people's feelings on these events, combining humor and entertainment with the real facts and official investigation narratives. The tour also notes the millions, if not billions, of Mexican pesos that are lost due to government corruption, For example, the billions lost to corruption in the acquisition of pharmaceutical pills by the Mexican Social Security system. In fact, it says a study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that corruption in Mexico accounts for 36% of all government services. I wonder what that figure is for malignant U.S. government agencies. Anybody have that info? It says, by the way, the tour is very interactive. As soon as it starts, questions are thrown out by the tour guides. They'll routinely ask questions like, how many of you have been asked by your own children or relatives about corruption? And how many of you have answered with a big knot in your stomach? What did you say? Were you able to explain it to their satisfaction? To your own satisfaction? Anyway, as the tour moves on, the final stop is the Mexican Senate building. It's our strategic final stop, the tour operators say, as she explains how the building and the costs of housing those legislators skyrockets yearly. Then she adds, the salaries of our legislators and their perks have recently doubled. Of course, she says, it's based on merit for such a fine job they're doing. Oddly enough, on nearly every corrupt tour bus ride, someone always asks the question, aren't you afraid to keep doing these tours? Do you fear one day you might be shut down or possibly even disappeared for making such an open issue of rampant government corruption? And with that, the tour operator usually laughs and says, every Mexican citizen knows the government's totally corrupt, just like they know the sky is blue. That's how our society works, or more precisely, sort of limps along. So to point out what everyone knows already, well, most politicians just shrug and laugh it off. In fact, they're so thick-skinned about it that even a few of them came on our maiden voyage and seemed to enjoy it immensely. Since then, other government leaders and politicians have bought tickets for future tours. All right, it's me, Johnny, again. You know, I'm not really surprised, but is that not weird? Oh, well, like my old grandma used to say, have fun, take chances, try things, but I don't think I want to try that tour. And Mexico for me, well, Cancun, Playa del Carmen, Yucatan vacations are great for a week or two, but that's about it for me. So then, what about Ecuador? Well, we spoke a little bit about it in the last few shows. And you know, one question I often get is, why have some Latin countries abandoned their currencies and adopted the U.S. dollar, like Panama, Ecuador, El Salvador, and Belize? It just seems so improbable. You go to a country that doesn't speak English except for Belize, and here they've got U.S. money that's got English printed all over it. And it seems the overwhelming majority of those questions about the U.S. dollar are coming in about Ecuador. So let's have a little history on Ecuador and why that came about. Well, we don't have to go too far back. Let's talk about 1997. There was a guy, president of Ecuador, called Abdallah Bakaram. Now, not even 6 months into his term, he was deemed mentally incompetent by the Ecuadorian Congress and forced out of his post as president. Imagine that, one legislator calling another mentally incompetent. Talk about calling the kettle black. All right, then in 1998 and 9, there was a huge Ecuadorian banking crisis. 70% of the nation's financial institutions closed their doors. Unemployment was at 17%. Officially, but people say it was as high as 40%. And their currency, called the sucre, depreciated by 200% in a single year. Total disaster, right? Well, you know, what's been happening in Venezuela makes that look like a walk in the park, but back then, that caused huge economic tremors in Ecuador's economy. Then, in the year 2000, in the wake of the collapse of the sucre, Ecuador became the very first South American nation to adopt the U.S. dollar as its currency. Now, at that time, millions of Ecuadorians lost their entire savings in the switch over to the dollar. And that year, Jamil Mahuad was forced to step down from the presidency following a military coup led by Lucio Gutierrez. Meanwhile, there were massive street protests by indigenous Ecuadorians, who made up around 80% of the population or more. So then, after all that turmoil and unrest, the people were ready for a brand new experience, and that's why they voted in Rafael Correa. You know, you got to give credit where credit is due, and he did straighten out the country in dramatic ways. He cleaned up Ecuador's public finances and did great repairs on the roads and highways in particular, But no politician can stay popular forever. The tide turns fast. And you know, now, along with the neighbors, Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, Ecuador, all of them being hammered by the collapse of oil prices to virtually half of what they were a few years ago, and oil being Ecuador's number one export, well, trouble soon followed. What you have to remember is that for a good part of Rafael Correa's term, that would be from 2009 to 2014, five whole years, oil consistently traded in the $80 to $100 a barrel range. However, from November 2014 to now, oil took a catastrophic hit, dropping far below $30 a barrel at one point, and now hovering around the $40 to $50 range. Which is why, all of a sudden, as I explained in a past show, so many taxes have been legislated in Ecuador in the last year. Most of them aimed at high-earning Ecuadorians and gringo expats, by the way. Anyway, for a country where oil accounts for between 40 to 50% of all their external export earnings, needless to say, their now bloated government is in a tough spot. So whatever you think of Correa as a president, and he did good things when he first came in, look at the historical facts. He is an avowed socialist. When times were good and oil was 100 bucks a barrel, he drastically increased all his state budgets, raised taxes, even in good times, and hired new public sector employees by the hundreds of thousands. Not to mention, he presided over a massive increase in Ecuador's external debt, leaving absolutely no fallback plan for a rainy day except to squeeze its citizens and foreign residents by raising taxes even more. And as it turns out, just like all countries who are almost totally dependent on oil for exports like Venezuela, Correa of Ecuador, like Hugo Chavez and Maduro of Venezuela, continuously drew up state budgets on the assumption that oil would indefinitely continue at 100 bucks a barrel or more. And of course, to please the common people and maintain permanent support, he, you might say, recklessly ramped up public expenditures and government hiring, paying absolutely no mind to the cyclic nature of the global commodities markets, oil being one of the prime global commodities. And the really amazing thing is, and I bet only one in maybe 10,000 people knows this, he's a PhD economist, a graduate of, give me a second, I gotta swallow hard here, the University of, get this, Illinois. Which begs the question, what in the hell kind of economics are they teaching at the universities in the States? I've been away a long time. I didn't know they were cranking out PhD socialists. Obviously, a pure Keynesian. And really, over the years, what an idiot doofus John Maynard Keynes has proven to be. Remember, he's the guy that invented the basic philosophy that a government could spend its way out of an economic crisis. No wonder modern legislators idolize the guy. But where were we? Oh yeah, there's something else strange about Rafael Correa, that illustrious PhD graduate from, I hate saying it, you know where. Anyway, throughout his multiple terms as president, Correa has been pounding his fist and saying, we're not going to sell pieces of our country to the United States or its capitalist big transnational business cronies any longer. Only what he's not telling you is that all through his term, he's been selling off Ecuadorian interests to, guess who? The Chinese, who've invested countless billions in the country. And before Correa was in office, not a Chinese investor in sight. Not even a real Chinese restaurant. Which begs the question, if you were president of a country, who would you rather sell your resources off to? U.S. or Chinese dickheads? Both pretty rotten choices if you want to maintain your sovereignty, but government is a cancer that needs to be fed and it doesn't care by whom. And you know, bottom line is, political pundits looking at Ecuador are saying if oil was still at 100 bucks a barrel, there's no doubt that Correa himself would be seeking an unprecedented fourth term. But because he had to do certain things like raise taxes over and over again, his popular approval rating has dropped to around 40%, which ain't bad. But when oil was 100 bucks a barrel, it was at 85%. Oh, and by the way, if you've been paying attention just this week, they had their first round of the election. And of course, Correa is not running. However, he says after the final election, which is coming up, he'll be heading to Belgium, his wife's home country, to pursue a career as an economic academic. Try saying that after a couple tequilas. Economic academic. Economic academic. By the way, you gotta love the names of some of the candidates running for president in Ecuador. There's one guy who's in the lead right now. His first name is Lenin, as in Vladimir Ilyich, not John. I mean, come on, who outside of Russia names their kid Lenin? And amongst others, he's running against an Ivan, another Russian throwback, and a guy whose first name is, you'll never believe it, Washington. So you've got a race with Lenin versus Washington. Could that be more stark? Yogi Berra would say deja vu all over again, right? So for those who might defend Korea, because he did bring the country out of devastation, you got to know this. Ecuador has the highest inflation rate for all dollarized countries in the world. Now, I know that doesn't mean much to gringos and expats setting their sights on Ecuador as their plan B destination. But you have to think about this. Even though Korea was president during the highest oil revenues in Ecuadorian history, oil was not the Ecuadorian government's highest income stream. The fact is, it was straight blood-sucking taxes that were their number one income stream. In fact, Ecuadorians now have about 30 different taxes and government fees that they have to routinely pay. Now remember, Rafael Correa says he's a socialist and has had a socialist government, which scares off brick-and-mortar private enterprise. And of course, you know, one of the fundamental principles of socialism and Korea's government is the redistribution of wealth, which history shows is only a redistribution of poverty in disguise. In fact, in a recent Argentine university study, it was determined that even if the Ecuadorian government did redistribute all the wealth of the richest people in Ecuador, the top 2%, the rest of the population would receive less than $5 each. Now, of course, it's painful to find out that the average person up in the States pays over 100 government taxes and fees every year. By the way, if you doubt that, I can send you the list. Just pop me an email. Still, the point is, when setting up your plan B, you don't want to move to a country that's following in the same idiotic footsteps as the one you're trying to leave. So in the end, that doesn't mean I don't recommend Ecuador as a great place for expats. No country is or can be perfect. They've all got their good, bad, the ugly, and the great. All right, that said, if you want to get on the early bird list for my July 2017 Expat Insiders Seminar in and around Guatemala again, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll put you on the early bird list. And don't forget about expatplanb.com. That's where you'll find my Expat Essentials course. Yep, it's the next best thing to getting boots on the ground, so do check it out.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own Plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own Plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my three videos. See ya. Nos vemos.